Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone. This is Ryan Tripp, the Native American Studies channel, as well as the Archaeology channel. I'm here with Professor Kathleen Hull and Dr. John Douglas. We're going to be discussing their new edited collection, Forging Communities in Colonial Alta California. Welcome.
Hello.
Thank you.
So to begin with, the book is, of course, Forging Communities in Colonial Alta California. It was published earlier this year by University of Arizona Press. Professor Kathleen Hull is an associate professor of anthropology at the University of California, Merced. Dr. John Douglas is director of research and standards at Statistical Research, Inc. He's also a visiting scholar in the School of Anthropology at the University of Arizona. Now, before we dive into this collection, I want to discuss a little bit this the cover art, the San Gabriel Mission cover art from the Laguna Art Museum. Why did you select this particular cover art for the collection?
Well, I think, first of all, we picked it because it really illustrates the colonial perspective on Native California. You've got in the background the mountains, which, you know, nature and so forth. In the middle portion of the picture, you have Mission San Gabriel, which is the subject of several of the chapters in our book. And then in the foreground, you have a native house and a number of native people interacting with colonists who are Gabrieleno or Tongva, who were the native peoples in the Los Angeles Basin at the time of contact and are still today the indigenous people of Los Angeles. So we picked this partially because it was just a, you know, very illustrative, pretty picture, but it also illustrated something that was went right to the heart of what our book was about, the interaction between Native Americans and colonists in a colonial setting.
So, by way of introduction, can you compare and contrast colonization across the Spanish Empire prior to 1769 with Spanish colonization in Alta California?
Certainly. So, obviously, Spanish colonization of the Americas began in 1492 with the landing of Columbus, and there was initial military conquests, the influx of deadly introduced diseases that decimated local native populations, the exploitation of natural resources and native labor through various systems that were sanctioned by the crown. And, of course, there were religious missions for both the conversion of native people to Catholicism and the exploitation of native labor. In this history, Spanish colonization of California was relatively late. The first mission was established in Alta California at San Diego in 1769. So the Spanish had strategies for empire, for colonialism, perfected really by the time they got to California. They had had substantial experience dealing with different native groups in different areas across North and South America. But this land was also relatively remote in the empire. It was distant from day-to-day control of the crown or the church. It was a challenging place to supply and support. But eventually, 21 missions were established by the Spanish. There were associated facilities with the missions. And also, there were ultimately 4 military presidios and several pueblos in Alta California. So there were similarities and differences sort of on the Spanish side. Now, from the native side, right, California was differed in terms of the native people that the Spanish encountered, different groups, different languages. Most of these groups were non-agricultural people, certainly those groups with whom the Spanish interacted mostly with on the coast. And they were politically and socially organized on a much more small and local scale than many of the groups that the Spanish had interacted with in Central and South America that had states or empires. So minimally, this usually meant less need for substantial armed conflict for the Spanish to gain a foothold in California or to maintain control in California. And the dominant force of Spanish colonialism was the missions, in this case, the Franciscan missions. But it also meant that the native people who entered the mission system were subject to much more profound changes in their daily life compared to many other people that entered Spanish mission systems elsewhere in the Americas. They were forced to transition from their traditional hunting and gathering life, where they likely moved their villages and camps on a seasonal basis and lived in extended kin groups. They moved into missions and became agriculturalists, working in the fields and working in the workshops at new crafts that were totally foreign to them.
Yeah, I might just add a few minor points. You know, when the Spanish and Portuguese really got going with colonialization, it really started in the 1200s with them going into the Azores and also Cape Verde. So you really, before the Spanish showed up in California, you're talking close to 500 years of this expansive treatment of indigenous peoples. And when you think about places like the American Southwest, which the Spanish first arrived in 1580s, 1590s, Coronado went through in 1598, went all the way to Kansas. They encountered very different people than these mobile hunter-gatherers in California. In the American Southwest, they were primarily agriculturalists. And so the Spanish were able to set up their churches right smack in the middle, in some cases, in the middle of pueblos within plazas, right smack in the middle of permanent structures built by native peoples. And so in California, it was a very different type of encounter and experience for the Spanish, where instead you have very mobile groups. And so the Spanish were setting up their pueblos, their churches, and so forth, sometimes close by to native villages, but they really had to attract these native peoples to come to them as opposed to the Spanish going to native peoples. So it was a very different situation through time.
I would also say that in the Spanish mission settings, whether we're talking about California or Florida or Texas or the American Southwest, native people were generally restricted in their movements within and beyond the mission walls, whereas traditionally native people had lived in family groups and extended families and kin groups. In the mission systems, unmarried men and unmarried women were separated from their families. They were living in barracks, and all native people were subject to surveillance and control by the missionaries. So it was certainly a very different life than what they had been used to. Also in California, one of the distinguishing characteristics or unusual characteristics of the time was that there was another major colonial player. And in this case, it was the Russians who had established Colony Ross along the north central coast of California. And the Spanish were reacting to or thinking about this Russian presence as they were also establishing expanding their foothold in California. They were, though the Russians were in California for a quite different reason, that was a mercantile operation focused on hunting fur-bearing sea mammals. The Spanish were anxious about the Russian presence and built built missions as close as they could to try and, you know, as a barrier to further Russian expansion in California.
What precipitated the initial migration of colonists from Sonora, Mexico to Alta California?
Well, I think that there were several things going on. You know, this Cortez showed up in Mexico in 1519, and by 1521 or 1522, he, along with allies, were already starting to expand and conquer other parts of Central America. So by the time of the Overland Expedition to California in 1769, you're talking about several hundred years have already gone by. And in the colonial core of Mexico, around Mexico City, there were very limited opportunities for indigenous people. Barb Voss talks about the caste system in some of her work and refers to a pigmentocracy, where people who are darker skinned have less opportunities than people that are lighter skinned within the Spanish caste system. And so, especially, I think, for people who were coming from Sonora and other places in northern Mexico, who were part of this initial overland expedition to California, they were looking for new social and economic opportunities. They were looking to get away from the very strict caste system in Central Mexico and forge new opportunities for themselves in California, get away from the Spanish crown. But at the same time, they were also representatives of the Spanish crown as part of this expanse into California. And so when you take a look at some of the research that's been done of those early colonists in Alta California, you see within a generation, people really changing their identity in California from one of being a colonist to one of being a Californian, of creating this new identity. And in the first census, a lot of these colonists self-identify themselves as mulattos, as mestizos, as a mixed ancestry in terms of the caste system. But 20 years later, at one of the subsequent censuses in California, you see this transformation of these same exact people then self-identifying as Spanish. And soon afterwards, many of the caste designations in the census went away, and it became this twofold interaction of you're either Native American or you're Spanish. And so I think many, many scholars have argued that what precipitated this initial migration was the interest in these colonists to seek some sort of economic and social opportunity that wasn't able to be offered to them back in the heartland of Mexico.
So, before Spanish incursions, how and why did Native Californians create community at various scales of geography and imagination?
Well, we know about Native life in California, traditional Native life in California, through a combination of evidence, certainly ethnographic evidence that was acquired by anthropologists working beginning around the turn of the century. We have ethnohistoric data, mission register data, historical accounts of interactions with Native people, and there's archaeological data as well. And from those various sources, we get a sense of how a community was created in Native California. One way this was done was obviously through day-to-day activities of people interacting as they were hunting or gathering or preparing food or caring for children or curing one another with Native plants. So they were sustaining one another both within and beyond the family through these sort of day-to-day actions of sharing and support and working together. Another way that community was created was through ties of marriage. And we know from ethnographic information that it was often prescribed that individuals had to marry outside their group. So exogamous marriage, marrying outside of one's immediate group. And this we know especially also from marriage records that were kept by Spanish missionaries. We see that marriages had to be renewed as Native people entered the mission system, because their marriages, their traditional marriages, were not sanctioned by the Catholic Church. So they renewed their vows, they renewed their marriage as they entered the mission system. And we can see that the husband and the wife, we can see which groups they came from. They're often groups that were located relatively close to one another, groups with whom they identified at birth. And so we see these marriage patterns across groups. So these practices of marriage formed networks, formed alliances, formed connections between families, between groups that might prove important in times of stress. So in times when there were shortages of food or when there were as aggression from other groups. Another way that communities were traditionally created was through the exchange of goods and information. We know from archaeology, for example, that there was a robust trade in obsidian, volcanic glass that was used to manufacture stone tools, or exchange in shell beads from the coast to the interior. And these weren't simply commercial interactions as we might conceive of them today. They also served to form relationships, to form networks, to form alliances, to forge communities. And then finally, there were communal religious practices. So, for example, annual mourning ceremonies, ceremonies that in which individuals of groups came together to mourn people who had passed away during the previous year. And these communal rituals, these communal ritual practices involved, you know, singing and dancing and feasting over a number of days. And these kinds of communal rituals especially were important given the fluid settlement system that was typical of Native California, where people moved with the seasons, or there were sort of fission and fusion as families came together and came apart over the year. And so these communal rituals, these communal religious practices brought people together and reinforced a sense of community identity and a sense of belonging for Native people.
Follow-up question. As editors and contributors to this collection, can you concisely and precisely explain what you mean by community?
Well, community has been, can be conceived or understood in various ways, and certainly has been by archaeologists, by anthropologists more generally. Typically, given the types of data that we have, archaeologists have often thought about or sort of conceived of community as sort of a place or sort of a scale of residence, say a village, that's between the household and the region in terms of scale. But we felt that this was much too limiting a kind of definition to apply, because it didn't really acknowledge different types or different scales of community that we were really interested in exploring. And one of the major sort of communities that's overlooked through a spatial approach are these so-called imagined communities, in which people rarely or maybe even never meet, but they share ideas, they share practices, they share values, they may even share identities that support the members of the community in some way, like nations or religions might do for people today. Just focusing on the spatial didn't really allow us to think about community in a constructive way, to think about how communities sort of persist over time from past to present, especially for contemporary Native communities. So we wanted to move away from this sort of spatial kind of approach to community and think about community as a social process. So following work of other scholars in this field, this isn't certainly not unique to us, we defined or we relied on the concept of community as a sense of belonging, that a community is just a is created and maintained through practices and experiences, through narratives, and through memories. There may or may not be a specific identity that is attached to it, but people gain something from this sense of belonging to a community, to a group of other individuals that are held together through some practices and values and experiences. And so communities, through this notion of a sense of belonging, They're brought into existence through these practices, through these experiences, and they're not something that's natural, right? This is something that people work at to maintain, to create, to establish because it's meaningful to them in some respect in their daily life. And obviously individuals can belong to multiple communities, communities that are based on economic exchange or communities that are based on other practices that tie people together and give them a sense of belonging.
I might just also add, within the context of this book, one of the reasons why we focused on the concept of community during the mission period was because you're able to draw from so many different types of data to look at this concept of community. Kathleen and I are both archaeologists, but I think that we both in some ways play ethnohistorians on TV in terms of being able to look at some different types of data, which we aren't quite as, we aren't experts in it, but we use it as tools to help complement the archaeology. So for example, during the mission period, a number of the chapters in our book are not only looking at things from an archaeological perspective in terms of excavations and other sorts of things that we've done, but also connecting it to baptismal records, marriage records, death records, a variety of different types of information that was collected by missions, presidios, pueblos within Alta California during the mission period. And together, we're able to form a much more complex and I think complete story about communities in Alta California during this time period than any one of those lines of evidence singularly would have offered.
How and why did the establishment of Spanish pueblos, missions, presidios, ranchos, and mercantile operations create new and dynamic relationships between colonists and native peoples throughout Alta California, as well as possibilities to conform to or depart from previous understandings of what a community could or should be?
Well, I think, when we think about the mission period in Alta California, we need to take a step back and think about what was there prior to the Spanish. Kathleen talked earlier about what life was like for these indigenous native peoples of California. They lived in small groups. They interacted with each other, but they were somewhat semi-autonomous. And then they were primarily hunter-gatherers. And then once colonists showed up on the scene, Native Californians were thrust into the thick of major changes within a generation of colonists showing up in 1769. In short order, the environment changed. The economic and social order changed rapidly, and interactions between Native Americans themselves, between each other, as well as between them and colonists, changed dramatically. Within a very short amount of time of Spanish colonists showing up, you started to see new economic goods showing up in California. You had glass beads coming from Europe. You had chocolate copper pots coming from Mexico. You had all sorts of goods coming from Asia over on the Manila galleons. And all of these together were being made available to these Native Americans. Foreign objects, which in some cases made their lives a bit easier, but what they generally tried to do was reorient these foreign objects within the context and social understanding that they had as indigenous people. And so in some cases, they were able to take these things and transform them in their own minds into something that they could relate to. For example, as Kathleen pointed out, for thousands and thousands of years, shell beads have been traded in California, but when glass beads showed up, many Native Americans took those not as an equal exchange with or transformation from shell beads, but as something complementary. And a number of scholars have pointed out that white glass trade beads were more popular among Native Americans across California, probably because they may represent in terms of color something like shell beads. And so within a relatively short amount of time, the social community of these relationships between Native Americans and colonists started to both be introduced and transform relatively quickly. And I think that both religion, as Kathleen pointed out earlier, and also social ties in general were some of the keys to these new relationships in terms of creating community between colonists and Native Americans.
I'll also add that, in any sort of colonial situation, right, your people on both sides of the interaction are confronted with new challenges and new opportunities. And as John mentioned, many of the colonists themselves, Spanish colonists, were involved in this migration, this colonization of California, because it provided, economic or social opportunities for them. And the same can be said of Native people as well, right? There may have been Native people who were seeking opportunities or responding to challenges in this context of interaction. And as part of this, as part of figuring out how to contend with this new reality with which they were faced, the opportunity to forge relationships, to forge community relationships with individuals, either non-Native people or with other Native people with whom perhaps Native groups had not traditionally interacted, may have been a really important strategy or an important need as people were trying to negotiate this period of turmoil. And in California, as elsewhere in the Americas, one of the challenges that Native people faced was the introduction of fatal non-Native diseases and, significant declines in population. So in this context of the introduction of new goods, interactions with new people, the imposition of new practices and different daily life on people, and significant population decline, we can imagine or we can anticipate that Native people in particular were trying to figure out how to persist both as individuals and as groups through a very challenging time that also, potentially provided opportunities for some individuals in ways that may have been important to them.
Why do you favor the notion of changing continuities as encompassing the arguments and evidence for the case studies in this volume?
It was important for us and important for the contributors to this volume to move away from notions that Native people in particular had to somehow remain the same through this period of time, to somehow, still be authentic, for example, or to move away from these notions of loss that had really sort of dominated a lot of the thinking about colonialism for many years among scholars. And so the notion of changing continuities, the fact that, people could change, right? Their practices could change, their beliefs could change. And yet in that change, that there was also continuity between past and present was really important to us as an idea, and important to us in part because of the potential significance or the potential impact of our work on contemporary Native people. So we worked from this notion of changing continuities, that we would expect to see both continuity and changing continuities between past and present as people negotiated the formation of new communities or the maintenance of communities that that already existed prior to colonialism. So we, drawing on the work of Lee Panitch, who's one of the scholars that was involved in this volume, we recognize that, you know, collective identity is constructed. So community is constructed, right? It's not something that's natural, that this construction happens through practice, through the things that people do and the things that people make, and that these practices draw on existing notions of, you know, in this case, the foundations of community, but also do so in a dynamic setting and in new ways as people, you know, recognize new ways to perhaps do things as well.
In addition, why is community as a sense of belonging and gratifying experiences crucial for understanding the essays in this collection?
Well, I think first and foremost, when we talk about a sense of belonging and gratifying experiences, that's the way that we're defining communities, because time and time again, in the essays in this book, those are some of the defining characteristics that people have identified as really creating community. It's these face-to-face relationships. Colonists in part created situations of belonging and these gratifying experiences with Native Americans through their interpersonal interactions, including, and I'll just give one example here, in the chapter that Kathleen and I and our friend and colleague Sita Reddy wrote, baptisms. We gave several examples in the first chapter in the book, looking at interactions between colonists and Native Americans from the perspective of colonists interacting with these Native Americans, and in some cases, baptizing Native Americans in danger of death. At the Native village of Umalawu, which is the name that Malibu comes from. Umalawu was the location where Malibu is today. One of the colonists who ran ranches in that local area clearly had a very interpersonal interaction with Native villagers from Umalawu. He married someone from that village. He baptized, in danger of death, one of the children of the capitan or chief of the village of Umalawu. In a number of the different case studies within the first chapter in the book, we look at some of these interrelationships in terms of ranchers interacting with the Native Americans living on the land where their ranch is. And in some cases, most likely, these Native Americans are working on the ranch as house help, as cowboys, as other sorts of field help, perhaps growing food in the fields. And in cases where some of these Native villagers, perhaps their children, are in danger of death, in the Catholic Church, the only time a lay person could baptize someone was in danger of death. And in some cases, some of these colonists literally were the godparents or baptized tens and tens of Native Americans over the course of their lifetime. And I think it really showed how pious these colonists were. And I don't think that for most Native Americans, the process of baptizing one of their indigenous children would have meant the same thing as for the colonists performing it. But at the same time, they allowed it. And I think it was because of this interpersonal connection with these colonists, with these rancheros. And so I think through those interpersonal interactions, and I think many times a number of the different chapters in our book, at least in part, are looking at either Catholic or indigenous religions as playing a strong part in at least some of these gratifying experiences or senses of belonging.
And I'll add to that. I think that this gets to the heart of, you know, why should we care about community, right? Why is this a topic that's worth studying? Why did we bother to, you know, bring these scholars together and think about this topic? And behind that is a sense that, or the you know, the belief that, you know, community exists for a reason, right? These are not natural communities. It's not just something that happens by accident. People actually work to create communities, and there's a social basis for community. And so if we move away from this place-based or sort of spatial approach to community that has been typical in archaeology and even in some other disciplines, we have to think about, you know, what were these gratifying experiences? What was this sense of belonging that was being created? What was this reason for community? What needs were being fulfilled? And I think that's why these ideas are important. This is, we're asking the question, you know, why did Native people and in some cases non-Native people, you know, put this effort towards creating community? What needs were being fulfilled? We want to understand you know, socially why this was important, why people made this effort. And that's really, you know, the driving force, the driving idea behind why we were pursuing this kind of research. We want to understand this in the past, and we want to understand the ramifications or the echoes of those processes and those efforts in the past, in the present.
If possible, can you elaborate on your introductory juxtaposition of the concepts of co-present community and reimagined community as applied to the case studies in this volume?
It was important to us, as I've mentioned before, to move away from just thinking about community as a residential space or as a place. As I mentioned, archaeologists often equate community with a spatial scale, a cluster of houses, a cluster of sites, a cluster of villages. And that's certainly one type of community and one way that some of the contributions to this volume think about community. And that's co-present, right? Where people are generally in the same place at the same time. And that's often how, you know, we think about community today. If we were to just ask somebody on the street what they thought community meant, they would probably think about it in terms of what we can call a co-present or a residential community. But another kind of community, and one that's very important in many of the case studies in this volume and important in the world today as well, is this idea of imagined communities. And this is a concept that was introduced into anthropology by Benedict Anderson. And what he said, and this is true, is that whether a community is grounded in you know, political basis or religious basis or some other sense of belonging, in many types of communities, people never meet face to face. They never are in the same place at the same time. And yet they still recognize a sense of community. They still recognize a sense of belonging together. And again, we can think of this today in terms of the nation state or perhaps belonging to a particular religion. These ideas of co-present and imagined are just two different sort of modes of time and space to think about different types of communities. A co-present community is where people are, for the most part, in the same place at the same time. And an imagined community is a community where people are not present in the same place at the same time, and yet they still share a sense of belonging. And this is important to us partly in this volume and what we were trying to do, because as we look at many Native communities today in the Americas, especially those that, you know, are not based in a reservation or do not have a land with which they most or all of the individuals live, it's really important to think about this idea of imagined community and recognize how communities are sustained in ways even when people are not living together day to day or interacting day to day, it's still a community. It's still a sense of belonging. It still may be a basis for identity and action for Native people today.
And I might just add on what Kathleen said, and just, you know, a few years ago, some colleagues and I looked at the concept of natural and imagined communities in the American Southwest, looking at the Anasazi from about 1,000 years ago. And we looked over the course of time at the archaeological record to try to understand something about this transformation in community from household-based to something much larger, including imagined communities. And I think we are successful in doing that. But at the same time, I found that study a little bit unsatisfying because it was still kind of conceptual. We could talk about the necessities of greater community, of interaction between groups and so forth, but we couldn't actually put our finger on who these people were. What communities were interacting with what communities beyond some general level from looking at the archaeological record. And I think that looking at the mission period again, I think really offers a different set of data where in a number of different case studies, we're actually able to look at archival records, ethnohistoric records to identify what villages and in some cases, what people may have actually been a part of this imagined community or co-present community, coming from different villages and coming together at certain times of year for certain celebrations. And we can see that through looking at mission records. And we know that in the case of Gwaspet, for example, we can clearly see there's marriage ties between Gwaspet and a number of different villages, including Pimu or Pimuwabit, which is off the coast of California on Santa Catalina Island. And Gwaspet had more marriage ties with Catalina Island than any other native village in the Los Angeles basin. And so to me, that really expands our understanding of what a co-present or imagined community is, because it's not just in the conceptual, but we can actually identify who some of these people were and how.
Now, you just touched on this, and I want to elaborate a little bit on your co-authored first essay in the collection, which, as you've already noted, is a case study of the creation of community in the colonial Los Angeles basin. Can you both elucidate the strong interconnections between Native Californians and colonists? You know, you've already mentioned the interactions between like Miguel Ortega and Umaliwo village, as well as the fission and fusion of native village tribelets that culminated in changing continuities of mourning rituals and feasting that in turn shaped the ethnohistory of Gwaspet Village, Mission San Gabriel, and maybe even the post-mission littoral borderlands in Marin County.
Sure. So the mourning ceremony, which is one of the things we talked about in our the first chapter in the book, is something that goes back at least 2,500 years. Kathleen and I, in a previous study, we published an article with another colleague of ours about some mourning ceremony activities that went on about 2,200 years ago on the bluffs overlooking what's known as the Bayona, just north of Los Angeles International Airport on the west side of Los Angeles. And we can see, we can understand from that experience something about the creation of community and what types of activities were done by community members to mourn their past family members or community members. And one of the things that Kathleen has identified down below at LAN 62 is the similar behavioral and performance patterns 2,000 years later during the mission period. You can see the same type of performance in terms of ritual breaking of artifacts, spittling with asphaltum, which is kind of a tar, a natural tar, covering with ochre, and just in general, some of the different types of activities associated with feasting and things like that that went on. And we know from more recent ethnographic studies, even dating to the 20th century, the 19-teens, the 1910s, anthropologists like Ruth Benedict, who Kathleen mentioned earlier, Duncan Strong, they documented the mourning ceremony among Kui and Serrano Native Americans in the desert communities west of, near Palm Springs and places like that during that time period. And so we're talking about a very long-lived tradition. And it's those types of activities that brought together Native Americans to help create community through time.
Just to follow up on that, as John mentioned, he and I and other archaeologists working in Southern California have been looking for and finding evidence of what we believe to be these communal mourning rituals. And based on ethnographic information, including some of what you might consider the first ethnographies in California by Spanish priests, document that people came together once a year, that they created items for these rituals, that they burned or otherwise destroyed these items as part of these rituals. And again, there was feasting and dancing and singing that went along with the destruction and the burial of these kinds of objects. And it's fascinating to me, you know, the sites that John and I have studied that date back more than 2,000 years in the coastal LA area. We see these same kinds of practices in the archaeological record during the colonial era, and yet we do see some changes from the archaeological record to the kinds of things, for example, that are described in the ethnographic record. So there's this continuity in terms of the continuing practice of communal mourning. But the items that might be used or the types of methods that might be employed to destroy or alter those items change somewhat over time. And yet we see this thread through time. And we can infer that these practices, these communal ritual practices, serve the same purpose in the past and present, right? That it brought people together, that it was a practice of community, that it reinforced the sense of belonging for Native people. And the fascinating thing that John especially has documented is that at the same time that people were continuing some of these practices of intermarriage and mourning ritual, they were also being baptized or being brought into Catholic religious practices through the ranchos that they worked on, for example. So it's this interesting, I don't want to say mixture, because both of these practices were happening simultaneously, but were reflecting the participation of Native people in two different communities at the same time. And this is something that's important for us to recognize, right? That it wasn't necessarily an either or, you belong to this or you belong to that, but Native people and non-Native people, I imagine too, were belonging to multiple communities simultaneously and gaining some sense of belonging, fulfilling some need through the participation in both of those or multiple communities that they were participating in at the same time. Even, for example, in this case, where there were communities that were both based on religious practices.
How and why do the case studies and material culture in the second section of the volume demonstrate that networks of trade and interfamilial relationships perpetuated political and ancestral communities, but also generated what you refer to as contingent communities?
Well, we were really so happy to work with scholars that were doing such interesting research in this particular area. So the cases that you refer to include one case study looking at the interior Chumash area, so sort of interior, the hinterlands of the Santa Barbara coast area. Another looking a little bit closer to the coast, the Cayuma Chumash in that same area. And then a third case study that was looking at Native people who entered the mission system at Mission Santa Clara in southern San Francisco Bay Area. And as you noted, each of these studies shows various networks that were established or that already existed and were maintained despite the turmoil of the mission period. So, for example, Julie Bernard and David Robinson, their study with the interior Chumash area, they saw that Native local people there were often interacting with Native refugees from the mission system. So people who fled the mission system sought refuge in this area, and people were exchanging goods, exchanging information, and this exchange of information and goods linked people together, often people who had been not related at all in any way or had only been distantly related in the past. And so people shared resources, they shared information. And this was especially important for people who were Native people who were seeking refuge and security and autonomy outside the mission system. And we see the same thing elsewhere in the Chumash area, where there were marriages between village chiefs or the families of those chiefs that linked those villages together into networks. And these are relationships that were created that could then be relied upon, including when Native individuals who had entered the mission system decided to leave for one reason or another, oftentimes being pursued by missionaries or the military who were trying to bring them back into the mission system. And those individuals could rely on these networks that had been established through these intermarriages of more elite families within the traditional Native landscape of the area. And similarly, Sarah Pilo and her colleagues studying especially the mission registers at Mission Santa Clara, she and her colleagues recognized that that even as Native people moved into the missions and were often interacting with Native people of different ethno-linguistic groups, right? People who spoke very different languages, people with whom they had not interacted with before. Native people in the mission system were maintaining connections to their homeland areas by continuing to marry within their ethno-linguistic group and maintaining the same kinds of marriage connections and networks that had existed prior to their entrance into the marriage, into the mission system. So even as the mission population became more diverse, it's clear that people were still making choices that in marriage that reflected traditional practices and these traditional sort of networks that they had relied on in the past. In some cases, again, she and her colleagues also recognized that more elite families that entered the mission system also tended to intermarry with more elite families in the mission system. So these same sort of traditional practices that created networks and relationships persisted into the mission period, either in the missions themselves or in the hinterlands in some cases. But the interesting question, thing that you noted about contingent communities, and this comes out especially in the work of Julie Bernard and David Robinson, is that these communities often were contingent. That is, especially in these hinterland areas, there were Native people who were coming and going as they were fleeing Spanish mission control. And so individuals in that particular context, and also perhaps in mission context as well, were making sort of day-to-day decisions about who was going to be a member of their community and what that community was going to be like. And these communities often were relatively ephemeral or somewhat unstable or definitely contingent because of the fluidity of what was happening at the time and the various forces that people, Native people in particular, had to deal with in this context.
I might just add a small thing, just to take this a little bit larger picture. When the Spanish showed up and started setting up missions, Native Americans had several possible choices. They could try to stay in their home village as long as humanly possible. But many times what would happen is when ranchos were established, a rancho boundary may encompass their village and a number of other villages. And so then at that point, their lands are being partially destroyed by horses and sheep and cattle. And so then at that point, they could either try to work on the rancho, they could lend themselves to be recruited to the missions. In some cases in California, arguably through the reducción, which was kind of a forced resettlement from villages to the mission, or they could flee. Native Americans that stayed on ranchos, padres at a number of missions, especially in Southern California, lamented that rancheros were protecting the Native Americans for their own economic interests because they needed help on their ranchos, while there was these competing sets of necessities by padres to recruit Native Americans to the missions so they could become Catholic and become essentially good citizens in the new Spanish Empire in California. And so for some people, yes, it was a very difficult decision to make, but fleeing to these hinterland areas, for some people, it was viewed as the only possible outcome for them. And it was, in all cases, it was very difficult. But I think that, the day-to-day, as Kathleen put it, the day-to-day decision-making by these Native Americans and these contingent communities in the hinterlands and places like the San Joaquin Valley were extremely difficult because you had Spanish military looking for you. You had rancheros looking for you. You had a wide variety of people trying to bring you back to the mission or to the rancho or somewhere else.
Yeah. Can you compare and contrast Colony Ross residential communities and their disparate populations as connections to hinterland peoples with the persistence of multi-scalar varieties of community in Mission Santa Clara, as well as with the shifting multi-ethnic communities of labor in the Pueblo of San Diego?
So Colony Ross was a Russian outpost. And so the people that were living there were Russian administrators or Creoles, people of mixed Russian and Native descent, also Native Alaskan hunters. So the Russians recruited Native men to hunt for seals and otters in California. And so those men came down to California. And then there were local Native people, so people, Pomo people, Miwok-speaking people, sometimes who married or were part of the community as the wives of Native Alaskan men, sometimes as laborers, as part of the broader undertaking that was Colony Ross. So some of the Native people that were living at Fort Ross or in Colony Ross had traditional ties to the land there and could move back and forth between their Native villages and the Native villages at Colony Ross. There was a fair amount of autonomy for Native people in that situation because it was a mercantile operation, right? It was very different than the Spanish mission system in California at that time. So it was a pluralistic community. There were people of both Native and non-Native and different Native groups of California and Alaska there. but a different sort of situation than we find in the mission system or in the pueblos. So when we think about Mission Santa Clara, which is one of the other case studies in this section of the book, in that case, we have Ohlone speaking people, so people who were sort of native of the Bay Area, and Yokut speaking people, so people who were traditionally lived in the Central Valley, the San Joaquin Valley of California. And over time, these two groups came to, as Spanish missions expanded their recruitment, Yokut's people started to be brought into the mission system as well. So at Mission Santa Clara, there were Yokut speaking people and Ohlone speaking people. And there, obviously, in the mission system, right, those native people are under surveillance. Their day-to-day activities are much more constrained than you see in the Colony Ross situation. But there were native villages as part of the mission system. There were indigenous spaces within Mission Santa Clara. And in those indigenous spaces, native people tried to maintain some of the practices that were important to them in terms of maintaining various communities, but they had to do so surreptitiously because they were under the surveillance of the missionaries. So they practiced mourning ceremonies and other kinds of ceremonies in their native villages away from the prying eyes of missionaries. But their day-to-day life was very controlled. And so they were not able to support one another in sort of the day-to-day practices of survival, say, that was more typical of Colony Ross. And then when we look at San Diego, the Pueblo of San Diego, this is later in time. And what we see there are Spanish and then Mexican settlers and American settlers as well. And most of the native people in that community were working as domestic servants in the households of either Mexican or American people in the Pueblo of San Diego. And there it was a challenge to the extent that native people wanted to create or maintain a community. It was much more of a challenge in that situation. Though they were living close to one another, they were in separate households, they had their other responsibilities to the people that they were working for, and they were suffering probably more so or in different ways from racism because of the community that they lived within. So each of these communities, they were people that were living together. They were living together in multi-ethnic communities, not just native and non-native, but often, you know, native people of very different or distinct traditions or cultures. And yet, people found ways to create community either through day-to-day support of one another, through ritual practices that harkened back to ritual practices in their traditional areas, or just through day-to-day interaction, not necessarily living together in San Diego, but living within proximity to one another where they could interact and support one another. And in the case of San Diego, ultimately, at least, they participated in a rebellion of sorts, an uprising of sorts, to try and gain a foothold or gain rights within the Pueblo of San Diego.
In his distant yet proximate comparisons between this volume's case studies on Alta California and his own examples of responses, processes, and post-processes in New Mexico, ethnohistorian James F. Brooks notes that we see the term dynamic used often in these studies, referring to the collection. He encourages scholars to recall that the word can mean unstable as well as forward-reaching. So in the final analysis, how does this collection help ethnohistorians and archaeologists better understand, as Brook avers, whether we are looking at familial or local responses to immediate shocks and their efforts to survive those exigencies, or the systematic and generational transmission at the cultural level to new forms of belonging?
Well, let me start, and then John, you can add if that's okay. I think that one of the important aspects of this volume is that we have these multiple case studies, right? We're looking at this issue of community formation or community maintenance across different geographies, across different times, across different groups. And so, and the authors in this volume very much took in the work of other scholars of the volume to make comparisons. And so this comparative approach, both between case studies and with the more distant past, because many of the contributors to this volume, most of the contributors to this volume are also archaeologists, we can see distinctions. We can see these different strategies that people used, and we can get at this issue of, you know, was it a local, or was this, a longer lasting, or was this processes that we see in more than one area? We can look for and we can identify common threads, and we certainly did in this volume, right? There were economic practices that brought communities together, forged communities, the religious practices, often drawing on traditional native practices, but also sometimes incorporating Spanish or Catholic practices. And those strategies were used to form or maintain communities. There was marriage and kin ties. And so there are commonalities that we can see that suggest that some of this is not just, they're certainly local responses, but they're part of a longer tradition and enduring practices of how Native and non-Native people forged communities. And because of the definition that we chose to look at communities as communities of belonging, it also allows us to think about, and scholars in this volume did, to think about how these practices and these strategies transcend time and space. We can look backward and see the continuity from the past. And we can also look forward and see how some of these same practices of religion or kin ties sustain and maintain Native communities in contemporary California. And so that's where we see this systemic, to use Brooks's words, the systemic and generational transmission, because we see some of the same strategies from the past into the colonial era and up to the present day.
I definitely agree with Kathleen. And I think I might just add that, the way James talked about dynamic as being both unstable and forward reaching, I think is very, very true. The colonial period was very unstabilizing for Native groups. Early on when the Spanish first started their colonial encounters back in the 1200s, 1300s, many times they weren't as interested in breaking down Native cultures as they were as gaining tribute or land, control of land and things like that. But later on during the colonial experience, once Spanish colonialization got more refined, they were much more interested in breaking down these cultural communities and turning them into citizens of the Spanish Empire, and more importantly, tax-paying citizens. And so when you look at California, Lee Panitch, one of the authors in this book, he published an article a few years ago in a journal called American Antiquity, the flagship journal for archaeologists, and he showed the distribution of federally recognized tribes in the state of California and the location of Spanish missions during the 17 and early 1800s. And the thing that's very striking about that figure is that those two different groups are almost completely discontinuous from each other. During the mission period, the Spanish were very, very good at breaking down cultural continuity of indigenous groups who they recruited to the missions. Clearly, these Native Americans continued. Clearly, these traditions continued. But it became much more difficult for these Native groups that were involved in the Spanish system to to keep that cultural continuity as strong and as established as those groups that were more, for example, in the periphery of the Spanish Empire at that time, in, for instance, desert communities. Many of those groups today are federally recognized, and under federal recognition policies in the United States, groups have to show this continuity of tradition, this continuity of group over several hundred years. And so I do think that even though we do see a lot of these changing continuities, the Spanish mission tradition really did have deleterious effects on a lot of Native groups in California.
And if I may just follow up one more comment, I think that Brooks's comment is important, right? That dynamic can mean unstable, and certainly the times through which Native people in particular lived through this colonial, or continue to live through in terms of colonialism, is destabilizing, can make groups or individuals challenged and create instability. But at the same time, as Brooks mentions, right, dynamism, dynamic can also be forward reaching. And I think that that's important, right? I think that if we think about the fact that in these very challenging circumstances, people were making decisions that were important to them, that were that allowed them to get or maintain the social support that they needed at the time, and potentially still need today, that people were adapting, they were adaptable, they were making decisions that reflect priorities that were important to them. And the fact that people made the choice, and this is what we argue, and the case study shows, people made the choice to invest in practices or to maintain practices that created or maintained communities. And that says something really important about what community meant to people then and what community means to people now. And so dynamic, yes, and dynamic also in not just dealing with instability, but also in looking forward and thinking about new practices or within the same strategies that people had used before, economic, religious, social, to maintain communities.
So I actually have one more question for both of you. So what is your what's next for both of you, or both of you together? Is it another project or a vacation or what? Professor Hall, you can go first.
Well, I would love to work with John again. We've worked together in the past. We've talked about working together in the future. We don't have a specific project in mind, but certainly our interests intersect. I am continuing to work on one of the archaeological collections from one of the sites in Southern California that first sort of inspired this work, which is a site, LAN 63, that I worked on with John many years ago. And I'm I looked at mourning rituals at that site, and I'm expanding that research to just think more broadly about this co-present community in that case, where people were living together about 2,000 years ago, and how they forged their identity, how they lived in a community, just to get a better idea of these co-present communities in the past. So I'm following this thread of community, but focusing a little bit more specifically about co-present community and the practices of co-presence in a community at 2,000 years ago in the Los Angeles Basin.
Dr. Douglas, what's up next for you?
Well, like Kathleen, I would love to work with her again. I think that we complement each other very well. In terms of our backgrounds and our interests. And I just love working with Kathleen. You know, one of the things I've been working in California for about 15 years doing colonial experience work. And one of the things that's really interested me is gaining broader perspectives from other parts of the world so that I can learn more about California. So, for example, a colleague and I last year had a book come out on the Spanish colonial experience in the American Southwest. And I'm working with another colleague of mine, Christine Bewley from University of Hawaii. We're working on a book with a number of scholars from five continents looking at Spanish and Portuguese colonial experience globally from roughly 1400 through the present. And so to me, it's been really gratifying working on this work in California because I've learned so much. And as I've kind of taken a bigger picture look, I've been able to really learn about patterns that are more global and then tie that back into my work in California.
Thank you both for being on the show today. I really appreciate it. So the collection is Forging Communities in Colonial Alta California, edited by Kathleen Hall and John Douglas, published earlier this year by University of Arizona Press. This is Ryan Tripp for the New Books Network and the Native American Studies Channel, as well as the Archaeology Channel. Please tune in next time.